This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Tell Me How It Ends, An Essay in 40 Questions by Valeria Luiselli. Read for you by Laurence Bouvard.
Introduction. In Tell Me How It Ends, there are no answers, only more questions. In this urgent, haunting, exquisitely written little book, the questions asked by Valeria Luiselli are her own, her children's, and those she finds on the questionnaire drawn up by immigration attorneys for the tens of thousands of Central American children who arrive in the United States each year after being smuggled across Mexico to the U.S. border. These children are the most vulnerable members of an ongoing exodus of Central Americans fleeing poverty and violence in their shattered nations, in the expectation of finding a better life in the United States. Many of the children are raped, robbed, or even killed along the way. As a Mexican woman living in the United States, facing her own travails with the Immigration Service for a green card that would grant her U.S. residency and permission to work, Luiselli became transfixed by the surge of child refugees during the summer of 2014. She began working as an interpreter with an immigration court in New York City, where she was given the task of assisting the children with the intake questionnaire, asking its questions of them in Spanish, and then translating their answers. Depending on those answers, they might or might not be granted legal sanctuary of some sort, and thus a future, in the United States. Luiselli soon realized it was impossible to fit the children's lives neatly into the boxes provided, observing, "The children's stories are always shuffled, stuttered, always shattered beyond the repair of a narrative order. The problem with trying to tell their story is that it has no beginning, no middle, and no end." The result of Luiselli's experience is this book, in which the questions posed to the refugee children become catalysts for her own questions about the nature of family, childhood, and community, and above all, about national identity and belonging. She offers a fascinating rumination on the complex nature of the attraction of the United States for the refugee children and their families, and even for herself. Despite its unwelcoming nature, casual racism, and official disinterest in their very existence. "Before coming to the United States, I knew what others know, that the cruelty of its borders was only a thin crust, and that on the other side, a possible life was waiting," she concludes. "I understood sometime after that once you stay here long enough, you begin to remember the place where you originally came from, the way a backyard might look from a high window in the deep of winter. A skeleton of the world, a tract of abandonment, objects dead and obsolete. And once you're here, you're ready to give everything, or almost everything, to stay and play a part in the great theater of belonging." Luiselli's book appears during an especially raw juncture in the relationship between her birthplace, Mexico, and her adoptive home, the United States. During the 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign, the nature of the relationship between the two countries became an essential plank in the candidacy of Republican billionaire Donald Trump, who notoriously referred to Mexicans as unwelcome intruders, as criminals, drug dealers, and rapists, and called for a wall to be built along the border, one that, in an apparent effort to be as humiliating as possible, he insisted, "Mexico will pay for." In this hallucinatory global political climate, in which bigoted notions about national identity, sect, and race have reared their heads to a degree not seen in many decades, Trump's statements gained him a sizable American following. It is distressingly clear that the fears and hatreds he has unleashed, especially since he, and not Hillary Clinton, won the election to become president, will not be easily put to rest. What does this mean for the refugee children and their families, who flee shattered communities to the United States, hoping to make themselves whole again? Luiselli does not know, but she feels certain that whatever the reception in the United States, the children will keep coming as long as there is a need to escape from realities too frightening to bear. Children run and flee, They have an instinct for survival, perhaps, that allows them to endure almost anything just to make it to the other side of horror, whatever may be waiting there for them. And what awaits them is a bewildering and often daunting reality, with little in the way of guidance to help them adapt. After 6 months adjusting to life in a tough neighborhood of New York, one Honduran youngster tells Luiselli what he has learned thus far. His new home is a shithole full of pandilleros, just like Tegucigalpa. In the course of her work, Luiselli's young daughter has heard about some of the children's stories, and she repeatedly asks, as children do, "Tell me how it ends, Mama." Luiselli has no answers for her. There are as yet no happy endings, but toward the end of the book she offers a small hint of promise. It comes in the form of a decision by 10 young Americans, just a few years older than the children of the intake questionnaires, to form a group that will help teenage refugees who have made it to the United States and managed to stay. This is a profoundly moving book, one that, with its modest 100 pages and simple, teasing title, presents itself as a mere story guided by 40 questions. But appearances are, after all, beguiling, and this is a most powerful story, beautifully told by Valeria Luiselli. I feel sure that whoever reads it will not regret it, nor easily forget it. John Lee Anderson, Dorset, England, January 14, 2017. Chapter 1. Border. Why did you come to the United States? That's the first question on the intake questionnaire for unaccompanied child migrants. The questionnaire is used in the Federal Immigration Court in New York City, where I started working as a volunteer interpreter in 2015. My task there is a simple one. I interview children, following the intake questionnaire, and then translate their stories from Spanish to English. But nothing is ever that simple. I hear words, spoken in the mouths of children, threaded in complex narratives. They are delivered with hesitance, sometimes distrust, always with fear. I have to transform them into written words, succinct sentences, and barren terms. The children's stories are always shuffled, stuttered, always shattered beyond the repair of a narrative order. The problem with trying to tell their story is that it has no beginning, no middle, and no end. When the intake interview with a child is over, I meet with lawyers to deliver and explain my transcription and occasional notes. The lawyers then analyze the child's responses, trying to come up with options for a viable defense against a child's deportation and the potential relief he or she is likely to get. The next step is to find legal representation. Once an attorney has agreed to take on a case, the real legal battle begins. If that battle is won, the child will obtain some form of immigration relief. If it is lost, they will receive a deportation order from a judge. I watch our own children sleep in the back seat of the car as we cross the George Washington Bridge into New Jersey. I glance back now and then from the co-pilot's seat at my 10-year-old stepson, visiting us from Mexico, and my 5-year-old daughter. Behind the wheel, my husband concentrates on the road ahead. It is the summer of 2014. We are waiting for our green cards to be either granted or denied, and in the meantime, we decide to go on a family road trip. We will drive from Harlem, New York, to a town in Cochise County, Arizona, near the U.S.-Mexico border. According to the slightly offensive parlance of U.S. immigration law, for the 3 years or so that we had lived in New York, we had been non-resident aliens. That's the term used to describe anyone from outside the United States, alien, whether or not they're residents. There are non-resident aliens, resident aliens, and even removable aliens that I know of. We wanted to become resident aliens, even though we knew what applying for green cards implied. The lawyers, the expenses, the many vaccinations and medical exams, the months of sustained uncertainty, the rather humiliating intermediate steps, such as having to wait for an advance parole document in order to be able to leave the country and be paroled back in like a criminal, as well as a legal prohibition against traveling abroad without losing immigration status before being granted advance parole. Despite all that, we decided to apply. When we finally sent out our applications, a few weeks before leaving for our road trip, we started feeling strange, somewhat out of place, a little circumspect, as if throwing that envelope in the blue mailbox on our street corner had changed something in us. We joked somewhat frivolously about the possible definitions of our new, now pending, migratory status. Were we pending aliens, or writers seeking status, or alien writers, or maybe pending Mexicans? I suppose deeper down, we were simply asking ourselves, perhaps for the first time, that same question I now ask children at the beginning of each intake interview. Why did you come to the United States? We didn't have a clear answer. No one ever does. But the deed was done. We had filed our applications, and while we waited for an answer, we were not allowed to leave the country. So when summer arrived, we bought maps, rented a car, packed a few basics, made playlists, and left New York. The green card application is nothing like the intake questionnaire for undocumented minors. When you apply for a green card, you have to answer things like, do you intend to practice polygamy? And are you a member of the Communist Party? And have you ever knowingly committed a crime of moral turpitude? And although nothing can or should be taken lightly, when you are in the fragile situation of asking for permission to live in a country that is not your own, there is something almost innocent in the green card application's preoccupations with and visions of the future and its possible threats. Polyamorous debauchery, communism, weak morals. The green card questionnaire has a retro kind of candor, like the grainy Cold War films we watched on VHS. The intake questionnaire for undocumented children, on the other hand, reveals a colder, more cynical and brutal reality. It reads as if it were written in high definition, and as you make your way down its 40 questions, it's impossible not to feel that the world has become a much more fucked up place than anyone could have ever imagined. The process by which a child is asked questions during the intake interview is called screening, a term that is as cynical as it is appropriate. The child, a reel of footage, the translator, interpreter, an obsolete apparatus used to channel that footage, the legal system a screen, itself too worn out, too filthy and tattered to allow any clarity, any attention to detail. Stories often become generalized, distorted, appear out of focus. Before the formal screening begins, the person conducting it has to fill in basic biographical information. The child's name, age, and country of birth. The name of a sponsor in the United States. The people with whom he or she is living at the time. And a contact number and address. All these details have to be written down at the very top of the questionnaire. A few spaces down, right before the first formal interview question, a line floats across the page like an uncomfortable silence. Where is the child's mother? Blank. Father. Blank. The interviewer has to write down whatever information the child can or will give to fill in those blanks, those two empty spaces that look a bit like badly stitched wounds. Too often, the spaces remain blank. All the children come without their fathers and mothers, and many of them do not even know where their parents are. We are driving across Oklahoma in early July when we first hear about the wave of children arriving, alone and undocumented, at the border. On our long westbound drives, we begin to follow the story on the radio. It's a sad story that hits so close to home, and yet seems completely unimaginable, almost unreal. Tens of thousands of children from Mexico and Central America have been detained at the border. Nothing is clear in the initial coverage of the situation, which soon becomes known more widely as an immigration crisis, though others will advocate for the more accurate term, refugee crisis. Questions, speculations, and opinions flash flood the news during the days that follow. Who are these children? What will happen to them? Where are the parents? Where will they go next? And why? Why did they come to the United States? Why did you come to the United States? I asked children in immigration court. Their answers vary, but they often point to a single pull factor. Reunification with a parent or another close relative who migrated to the U.S. years earlier. Other times, the answers point to push factors. The unthinkable circumstances the children are fleeing. Extreme violence, persecution and coercion by gangs, mental and physical abuse, forced labor, neglect, abandonment. It is not even the American dream that they pursue, but rather the more modest aspiration to wake up from the nightmare into which they were born. Then comes question number 2 in the intake questionnaire. When did you enter the United States? Most children don't know the exact date. They smile and say, last year, or a few months ago, or simply, I don't know. They've fled their towns and cities. They've walked and swum and hidden and run and mounted freight trains and trucks. They've turned themselves into border patrol officers. They've come all this way looking for what? Exactly. The questionnaire doesn't make these other inquiries, but it does ask for precise details. When did you enter the United States? As we drive deeper into the country, following the enormous map I take from the glove box and study from time to time, the summer heat becomes drier, the light thinner and whiter, the roads more solitary. We start hunting down any available information about the undocumented children and the situation at the border. We collect local newspapers, which pile on the floor of our car in front of my co-pilot seat. We do constant quick online searches and tune into the radio every time we can catch a signal. More questions, speculations, and opinions flood media coverage of the crisis. Some sources elaborate lucid and complex conjectures on the origin and possible causes of the sudden surge of arrivals of unaccompanied minors. Others denounce the inhumane conditions and systematic maltreatment the children must endure in detention facilities near the border, and a few others endorse the spontaneous civilian protests against them. A caption in a web publication explains an unsettling photograph of men and women waving flags, banners, and rifles in the air. Protesters, some exercising their open carry rights, assemble outside of the Wolverine Center in Vassar, Michigan, that would house illegal juveniles, to show their dismay for the situation. In another photograph that we find on the web, an elderly couple holds signs saying, "Illegal is a crime," and "Return to senders." They are sitting on beach chairs, wearing sunglasses. A caption explains, "Thelma and Don Christie, C, of Tucson, demonstrate against the arrival of undocumented immigrants in Oracle, Arizona, July 15, 2014. I zoom in on their faces and wonder, what passed through the minds of Thelma and Don Christie when they prepared their protest signs? Did they pencil in protest against illegal immigrants on their calendars, right next to mass and just before bingo? What were they thinking when they put their beach chairs inside their trunk? And what did they talk about as they drove the 40 miles or so north toward the protest in Oracle? In varying degrees, some papers and web pages announce the arrival of undocumented children like a biblical plague. Beware the locusts. They will cover the face of the ground so that it cannot be seen. These menacing, coffee-colored boys and girls with their obsidian hair and slant eyes. They will fall from the skies, on our cars, on our green lawns, on our heads, on our schools, on our Sundays. They will make a racket. They will bring their chaos, their sickness, their dirt, their brownness. They will cloud the pretty views. They will fill the future with bad omens. They will fill our tongues with barbarisms. And if they are allowed to stay here, they will, eventually, reproduce. We wonder if the reactions would be different were all these children of a lighter color, of better, purer breeds and nationalities. Would they be treated more like people? More like children? We read the papers, listen to the radio, see photographs, and wonder. In a diner near Roswell, New Mexico, we overhear a conversation between a waitress and a customer. As she refills his coffee, she tells him that hundreds of migrant kids will be put on private planes, rumored to have been funded by a patriotic millionaire, and deported that same day back to Honduras, or Mexico, or somewhere. The planes full of alien children will leave from an airport not far from the famous UFO museum, the one our children have been set on visiting. The term alien, which only a few weeks ago made us laugh and speculate, which we'd been passing around the car as an inside family joke, is suddenly shown to us under a bleaker light. It's strange how concepts can erode so easily, how words we once used lightly can alchemize abruptly into something toxic. The next day, driving out of Roswell, we look for news on what happened with those deportees. We find no details of the exact circumstances under which they were deported, or how many there were, and if it's true that a local millionaire financed their removal. We do, however, come across these lines in a Reuters report that read like the beginning of a cruel, absurdist story by Mikhail Bulgakov or Daniil Harms. Looking happy, the deported children exited the airport on an overcast and sweltering afternoon. One by one, they filed into a bus, playing with balloons they'd been given. We dwell for a time on the adjective happy, and the strangely meticulous description of the local weather in San Pedro Sula, Honduras, an overcast and sweltering afternoon. But what we really cannot stop reproducing, somewhere in the dark back of our minds, is the uncanny image of the children holding those balloons. In our long daily drives to fill in the empty hours, we sometimes tell our children stories about the old American Southwest, back when it used to be part of Mexico. I tell them about St. Patrick's Battalion, the group of Irish Catholic soldiers who joined the U.S. Army as cannon fodder during the Mexican-American War, but later changed sides to fight along with the Mexicans. I tell them about the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, signed after that war, in which Mexico lost half its territory to the United States. Their father tells them about President Andrew Jackson's Indian Removal Act, approved by Congress in 1830, and explains how it brutally exiled Native Americans to reservations. He tells them about Geronimo, Cochise, Mangas Coloradas, and the other Chiricahua Apaches, the last inhabitants of a continent to surrender to the White Eyes, after years of battle against both the U.S. Bluecoats and the Mexican Army. Those last Chiricahua resisted for many more years after the Indian Removal Act was passed. They finally surrendered in 1886 and were removed to the San Carlos Reservation in southern Arizona, toward which we are now driving. It's curious, or perhaps just sinister, that the word removal is still used to refer to the deportation of illegal immigrants, those bronzed barbarians who threaten the white peace and superior values of the land of the free. When we run out of stories to tell our children, we fall silent and look out at the unbroken line of the highway, perhaps trying to put together the many pieces of the story, the unimaginable story, unfolding just outside the small and protected world of our rented car. Though all of it resists a rational explanation, we talk it over and consider its many angles. We try to answer our own children's questions about the situation as best we can, but we don't do very well. How do you explain any of this to your own children? The third and fourth questions on the intake questionnaire are ones that our children, too, ask many times, though in their own words. With whom did you travel to this country? And did you travel with anyone you knew? All children travel with a paid coyote. Some of them travel also with siblings, cousins, and friends. Sometimes when our children fall asleep again, I look back at them, or hear them breathe, and wonder if they would survive in the hands of coyotes, and what would happen to them if they were deposited at the U.S. border, left either on their own or in the custody of Border Patrol officers. Were they to find themselves alone, crossing borders and countries? Would my own children survive? The fifth and sixth questions are, what countries did you pass through? And how did you travel here? To the first one, almost everyone immediately answers Mexico, and some also list Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. To the question about how they traveled here, with a blend of pride and horror, most say, I came on La Bestia, which literally means the beast, and refers to the freight trains that cross Mexico, on top of which as many as 500,000 Central American migrants ride annually. There are no passenger services along the routes, so migrants have to ride atop the rail cars or in the recesses between them. Thousands have died or been gravely injured aboard La Bestia, either because of the frequent derailments of the old freight trains or because people fall off during the night. The most minor oversight can be fatal. Some compare La Bestia to a demon, others to a kind of vacuum that sucks distracted riders down into its metal entrails. And when the train itself is not the threat, it's the smugglers, thieves, policemen, or soldiers who frequently threaten, blackmail, or attack the people on board. There's a saying about La Bestia, go in alive, come out a mummy. But despite the dangers, people continue to take the risk. Children certainly take the risk. Children do what their stomachs tell them to do. They don't think twice when they have to chase a moving train. They run along with it, reach for any metal bar at hand, and fling themselves toward whatever half-stable surface they may land on. Children chase after life, even if that chase might end up killing them. Children run and flee. They have an instinct for survival, perhaps, that allows them to endure almost anything, just to make it to the other side of horror, whatever may be waiting there for them. La Bestia's roots start either in the town of Tapachula, in the state of Chiapas, or in Tenosique, in the state of Tabasco, both towns near the Mexico-Guatemala border. They slowly make their way up to the U.S.-Mexico border, following either the Eastern Gulf route to Reynosa, the border town near the southeasternmost tip of Texas, or the western routes that lead either to Ciudad Juarez in Chihuahua or to Nogales in Sonora, which share borders with Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. The journey atop La Bestia's freight trains ends at the U.S.-Mexico border. And there begins another journey, one that is not as dangerous, objectively speaking, but is equally terrifying in the children's eyes. Once off La Bestia, and having reached the border, the coyote's job is usually done, and the children are on their own. They try to turn themselves into the Migra, or Border Patrol, as soon as possible. They know their best bet is to be formally detained by Border Patrol officers. Crossing the desert beyond the border alone is too dangerous, if not impossible. They also know that if they are not caught at this point, or if they do not surrender themselves to the law, it is unlikely that they will arrive at their final destination, the home of a relative in some city, usually far from the border. If the legal proceedings don't begin now, their fate will be to remain undocumented, like many of their parents or adult relatives already in the United States. Life as an undocumented migrant is perhaps not worse than the life they are fleeing, but it is certainly not the life that anyone wants. So the children who cross the border into the desert try to stick to the busier roads and walk openly along highways until someone, hopefully an officer and not a vigilante, sees them. I remember a teenager who, during an interview in court, told me of his increasing desperation when, after hours of walking the arid plains of New Mexico, the Border Patrol still hadn't appeared. It was not until his second day of walking in the desert under the burning sun that a vehicle finally appeared on the far horizon. He stood in the middle of the road, waving his arms. And when the vehicle pulled over beside him, to his immense relief, two tall officers stepped out and detained him. "My mom always told me I was born under a lucky star," he said when he finished his story. As soon as a child is in the custody of Border Patrol officials, he or she is placed in a detention center, commonly known as the hielera, or the icebox. The icebox derives its name from the fact that the children in it are under ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, custody. The name also points out the fact that the detention centers along the border are a kind of enormous refrigerator for people, constantly blasted with gelid air, as if to ensure that the foreign meat doesn't go bad too quickly. Naturally, it must be harboring all sorts of deadly germs. The children are treated more like carriers of diseases than children. In July 2015, for example, the American Immigration Lawyers Association, AILA, filed a complaint after learning that in a detention center in Dilley, Texas, 250 children were mistakenly given adult-strength hepatitis A vaccinations. The children became gravely ill and had to be hospitalized. By law, the maximum time a person can remain in the icebox is 72 hours, but children are often kept for longer, subject not only to the inhumane conditions and frigid temperatures, but also to verbal and physical mistreatment. They sometimes have nowhere to lie down to sleep, are not allowed to use the bathrooms as frequently as they need to, and are underfed. "They only give out frozen sandwiches twice a day there," another teenager I once screened told me. "That's all you ate?" I asked. "No, not me." "What do you mean, not you?" "I didn't eat those things." "Why not?" "Because they give belly sadness." As we drive from southwestern New Mexico toward Arizona, it becomes more and more difficult to ignore the uncomfortable irony of it. We are traveling in the direction opposite to the children whose stories we are now following so closely. As we get closer to the border and begin taking back roads, we do not see a single migrant, child or adult. We see other things, though, that indicate their ghostly presence, past or future. Along the narrow dirt road in New Mexico that goes from a ghost town called Shakespeare to another town called Animas, we see a trail of flags that volunteer groups tie to trees or fences, indicating that there are tanks filled with water there for people to drink as they cross the desert. Occasionally, we are overtaken by big pickup trucks, and it's hard not to imagine the men behind their steering wheels. Big men, with beards or shaved heads, or abundant tattoos. Vigilant, patriotic men, who carry pistols and rifles by constitutional right, and feel entitled to use them if they see a group of aliens walking in the desert. As we approach Animas, we also begin to see fleeting herds of Border Patrol cars, like ominous white stallions racing toward the horizon. We decide not to tell anyone in diners and gas stations that we are Mexican, just in case. But we are stopped a few times by Border Patrol officials and have to show our passports and display big smiles when we explain we're just riders and just on vacation. We have to confirm that, yes, we are only riders, even if, yes, we are also Mexican. "Why are we there, and what are we writing?" they always want to know. "We are writing a Western, sir." That's what we tell them, that we are writing a Western. We also tell them we came to Arizona for the open skies and the silence and the emptiness. This second part, more true than the part about writing the Western, which is untrue. Handing back our passports, one official says sardonically, "So you come all the way down here for the inspiration." We know better than to contradict anyone who carries a badge and a gun, so we just say, "Yes, sir." Because how do you explain that it is never inspiration that drives you to tell a story, but rather a combination of anger and clarity? How do you say, "No, we do not find inspiration here, but we find a country that is as beautiful as it is broken, and we are somehow now part of it, So we are also broken with it and feel ashamed, confused, and sometimes hopeless, and are trying to figure out how to do something about all that. We roll the windows up and keep driving, to distract ourselves from the aftertaste of the Border Patrol encounter. I look for a playlist and press shuffle. One song that often pops up is Straight to Hell by The Clash. We didn't suspect that that song would become a kind of leitmotif of our trip. Who would have known that a song partly about the post-Vietnam War Amerasian children and their exclusion from the American dream would become, 40 years later, a song about Central American children in the American nightmare? It's Icy Lines, about no man's land, about a place with no asylum. Give me belly sadness. Question 7 on the questionnaire is, did anything happen on your trip to the U.S. that scared you or hurt you? The children seldom give details of their experiences along the journey through Mexico upon a first screening, and it's not necessarily useful to push them for more information. What happens to them between their home countries and their arrival in the United States can't always help their defense before an immigration judge, so the question doesn't make up a substantial part of the interview. But as a Mexican, this is the question I feel most ashamed of, because what happens to children during their journey through Mexico is always worse than what happens anywhere else. The numbers tell horror stories. Rapes. 80% of the women and girls who cross Mexico to get to the U.S. border are raped on the way. The situation is so common that most of them take contraceptive precautions as they begin the journey north. Abductions. In 2011, the National Human Rights Commission in Mexico published a special report on immigration abductions and kidnappings, revealing that the number of abduction victims between April and September 2010, a period of just 6 months, was 11,333. Deaths and disappearances. Though it's impossible to establish an actual number, some sources estimate that, since 2006, around 120,000 migrants have disappeared in their transit through Mexico. Beyond the terrifying but abstract statistics, many horror stories have recently tattooed themselves in the collective social conscience in Mexico. One specific story, though, became a turning point. On August 24, 2010, the bodies of 72 Central and South American migrants were found, piled up in a mass grave, at a ranch in San Fernando, Tamaulipas. Some had been tortured, and all had been shot in the back of the head. Three migrants in the group had faked their deaths, and though wounded, survived. They lived to tell the complete story. Members of the drug cartel Los Zetas had perpetrated the mass murder after the migrants had refused to work for them and did not have the means to pay a ransom. I remember the dark days when this news broke out in Mexico. Thousands or perhaps millions of people in front of newspapers, radios, and TV screens, all of them asking, how? Why? What did we do? Where did we go wrong as a society to make something like this possible? Even now, we don't know the answer. No one does. What we do know is that, since then, hundreds of additional mass graves have been discovered. Every month, every week, they continue to be discovered. And even though the story of Los 72, the 72 men and women, girls and boys, all brutally murdered, changed the way in which both Mexican society and the rest of the world views the situation of migrants crossing Mexican territory, nothing has actually been done about it. There are, of course, some redeeming stories in Mexico. There is the story of Las Patronas, the group of women in Veracruz, who years ago started throwing bottled water and food to the migrants aboard La Bestia, and are now a formal humanitarian group. There are also the many shelters that offer food and refuge to migrants as they travel through Mexico, the most well-known of which is Hermanos en el Camino, run by Father Alejandro Soladlinde. but these stories, small oases in the no man's land Mexico has become, are only exceptions. If anything, they are fleeting glints of hope in the dark and raucous nightmare where the metal wheels of La Bestia continually screech and howl. So when I have to ask children that seventh question, did anything happen on your trip to the U.S. that scared you or hurt you? All I want to do is cover my face and my ears and disappear. But I know better, or try to. I remind myself to swallow the rage, grief, and shame. Remind myself to just sit still and listen closely. In case a child does happen to reveal a particular detail that can end up being key to his or her defense against deportation. The danger migrants face in their journeys doesn't end when they finally reach the U.S.-Mexico border. Question number 8 addresses crimes and rights violations in U.S. territory. Has anyone hurt, threatened, or frightened you since you came to the U.S.? There are many stories about such violations. Some are liminal, like the well-known case of a 16-year-old boy on the Mexican side of the border, who in 2012 was shot to death by an American officer on the U.S. side, who later claimed the boy and other people had thrown rocks at him. The officer argued self-defense, his bullets for their rocks. And the dangers continue once the border is crossed. We know, for instance, that civilian vigilantes and owners of private ranches go out to hunt undocumented migrants, either as a matter of conviction or merely for sport. Many migrants also die of dehydration, hunger, or accidents. At the Forensic Institute of Pima County, Arizona alone, more than 2,200 human remains have been registered since 2001, the majority of which are still unidentified. The area surrounding the border between Mexico and the United States is a big common grave, and the migrants who die in this portion of our continent become no more than bones in the desert. As Sergio González Rodríguez once said about the many women murdered in and around Ciudad Juárez during the peak of the femicide crisis, perhaps also foreshadowing the destiny of many more people. It is almost impossible to identify human remains recovered from the desert, as they are frequently discovered in a very advanced state of decomposition, and the lines of communication between family members looking for their missing and the institutions responsible for the remains are limited, if not completely absent. One notable effort to counter this desolating map of current and future anonymous dead was organized by the nonprofit Humane Borders, which, among other important work, created an online search mechanism that matches names of deceased migrants to the specific geographical coordinates in the desert where their remains were found. That way, family members of the missing can type a name into a search bar and either confirm their worst fears when the map zooms in on a red dot in the desert, or continue to wait and hope. Writer and former Border Patrol officer Francisco Cantú has written poignantly about these death maps and all the clearly marked ghosts that dot the wide deserts in the southern United States. Numbers and maps tell horror stories, but the stories of deepest horror are perhaps those for which there are no numbers, no maps, no possible accountability, no words ever written or spoken. And perhaps the only way to grant any justice, were that even possible, is by hearing and recording those stories over and over again, so that they come back always to haunt and shame us. Because being aware of what is happening in our era and choosing to do nothing about it has become unacceptable. Because we cannot allow ourselves to go on normalizing horror and violence. Because we can all be held accountable if something happens under our noses and we don't dare even look. We returned to Manhattan at the end of the summer of 2014. The family's green cards were waiting for us in a stack of mail piled high by the door. All of them, except mine. My stepson went back to Mexico. My daughter went back to school. My husband and I went back to work, and life went back to normal. Almost. I still had to figure out what to do with my lost green card. So I began to consult my lawyer regularly. We discussed possible reasons for the delay. Maybe, she suggested, Homeland Security was doing a more thorough background check. Do you travel to Muslim-majority countries? My lawyer asked more than once. I had only been to Jordan and Turkey, and that was 10 years before. Are you sure? I went to Indonesia as a girl, I remembered when, on another phone call, she repeated the question. There were other questions. Have you been a member of any organization that represents a threat to the United States? My answer was probably boring. I'm a veteran member of the United World Colleges and a recent member of both the Modern Language Association and the Association of Writers and Writing Programs. Congregations of nerds, basically, with a certain enthusiasm for education, academics, and literature. Her questions seemed increasingly unreasonable and bizarre. But we had to come up with plans B and C, so I complied and answered, filed more petitions, and spent endless hours on the customer service line for the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS. We had already applied for temporary work permits, which came in the mail a few months later. But there was still no sign of my green card. We looked for other solutions, until one day my lawyer told me she had to hand my case over to someone else because she had just been offered a job at a nonprofit organization, working on cases defending child migrants, and had to give up her private practice. Ever since I was left somewhat alone, without gods, I had been a ferocious believer in the power of small coincidences. That is how chance works, at least for those of us who do not have the certainty of grander schemes. It was thanks to my lost green card, and thanks to my lawyer abandoning my case, that I became involved with a much more urgent problem. My more trivial pursuits as an alien writer or pending Mexican took me into the heart of something larger and more important. As I walked down Broadway one morning, speaking to my lawyer over the phone one last time before she handed off my case, I inquired about her new job. She explained that the Obama administration had decided to create a priority juvenile docket in immigration courts to deal with the deportation proceedings of thousands of undocumented children. Suddenly, with a surge of arrivals, there was an urgent demand for lawyers in the immigration courts, and thus she'd have been offered this new position. Since the majority of lawyers were monolingual, she explained, there was a special need for lawyers who, like her, spoke Spanish. Before we hung up, I asked if there was a need for translators or interpreters in court, even if they weren't lawyers. And she said, of course, there was. I still had questions as we hung up, but not the right words to articulate them at that moment. What was the priority juvenile docket? Who was defending these children, and who was accusing them, and of what crime exactly? She put me in touch with a lawyer from the American Immigration Lawyers Association that same day. Chapter 2. Court. I started working as an interpreter in the New York Immigration Court in March 2015. I convinced my 19-year-old niece to come with me, at least for the first day. She had just moved to New York, was living with us, and was waiting for her college application results. Her life was, as it should be for anyone at that point, a wild and beautiful mess. On our first day of work, my niece and I took the subway downtown in the early morning and walked to the big, ominous building at 26 Federal Plaza. The security procedures to enter the building are a little like the ones at an airport. You have to show your passport, take off your jackets, scarves, and shoes, deposit your bags on an inspection belt, and go through a metal detector monitored by police. Inside, the building branches vertically and horizontally into hallways, offices, windows, courtrooms, and waiting rooms. There are few signs, and few people you can ask for assistance or directions, so it's easy to get lost. The building's labyrinthine architecture is, in a way, a replica of the U.S. immigration system. And as in any labyrinth, some find their way out, and some don't. Those who don't might remain there forever, invisible specters who go up and down elevators and wander the hallways, imprisoned in circular nightmares. A lawyer from the AILA, whom I had contacted by phone a few months earlier, met us on the ground floor of the building. She led us to the 11th floor, and there she introduced us to two lawyers from The Door, a Manhattan-based nonprofit that provides kids and teenagers with services ranging from legal assistance to counseling to English and hip-hop classes, with whom we would be working that day and over the following months. After the official introductions, the lawyers from The Door asked us to wait for a while in the little room adjacent to the one where the interviews are conducted. We had arrived too early. They hadn't finished planning the agenda for the day, and no children had shown up yet. I picked a chair in the waiting room, and my niece went to peek into the screening room where the lawyers were preparing, through the door left ajar. She promptly returned to report, with pride and enthusiasm in keeping with her age, that all the staff members from The Door were young women. I responded with a stoic nod, perhaps in an effort to display more fortitude and aplomb than I have, to appear neither moved by her comment nor frightened by what awaited us on the other side of the door. Soon after, the lawyers led us into the screening room, where they outlined the procedure we would follow. The plan on that first day was for each of us to shadow a lawyer, learning how to use the intake questionnaire and how to conduct the interviews. Once we were familiar with the process, we would interview the children directly without a lawyer. But so many children showed up that morning that the lawyers decided to hand us packets with copies of the intake questionnaire and trust that we'd do the job well on our own. We had no idea what we were doing. No idea of the depth and magnitude of what we were dealing with. Between the summer of 2014 and the first months of 2015, when my niece and I began working in court, constant coverage of the children's crisis had slowly made the general picture a little clearer for everyone who followed the news. This much, at least, became clear. Most children came from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, the three countries that make up the Northern Triangle, and practically all of them were fleeing gang violence. Although the flow of youths migrating alone to the United States from these territories had been observed for years, there had been a considerable and sudden increase in the numbers. From October 2013 to the moment the crisis was declared in June 2014, the total number of child migrants detained at the border approached 80,000. This sudden increase set off alarms in the United States and provoked the declaration of the crisis. Later, in the summer of 2015, it became known that between April 2014 and August 2015, more than 102,000 unaccompanied children had been detained at the border. The room where screenings are conducted in the New York Immigration Court feels improvised, like a small refugee camp occupied temporarily by local organizations and the children they screen tirelessly every day. The space resembles a church, a rectangle, vast and austere, furnished only with benches lined up one after another. At its front, a wooden balustrade with a little door in the center cordons off an area with two large mahogany tables at which the children, lawyers, and interpreters sit for the interviews. Crayons and pads of paper are set out at the ends of the tables to entertain the younger children. During each interview, the child's relatives sit on the benches on the other side of the balustrade and wait, like spectators in the silent mass. It's against protocol for relatives to join the children during the interviews, since their presence could influence the answers they give. Against the walls of the room, instead of the statues of saints or paintings that would decorate a church, are movable chalkboards on which lawyers and interpreters make notes, and children draw and scribble while they wait their turn. We didn't quite grasp the bigger picture during our first hours in court conducting screenings. Blindly, we simply followed all the questions on the intake questionnaire, one by one, and translated the answers. What we were really doing there that morning was providing backup for organizations dealing with an emergency. Not the emergency at the border, detonated with the surge of arrivals, but the quieter, more bureaucratic, legal emergency created by the federal government's decision to create a priority juvenile docket in response to that surge. Before the immigration crisis was declared in the summer of 2014, minors seeking immigration relief were given approximately 12 months to find a lawyer to represent their case before their first court hearing. But when the crisis was declared, and Obama's administration created the priority juvenile docket, that window was reduced to 21 days. In real and practical terms, what the creation of that priority docket meant was that the cases involving unaccompanied minors from Central America were grouped together and moved to the top of the list of pending cases in immigration court. Being moved to the top of a list in this context was the least desirable thing, at least from the point of view of the children involved. Basically, the priority juvenile docket implied that deportation proceedings against them were accelerated by 94%, and that both they and the organizations that normally provided legal representation now had much less time to build a defense. Nonprofit organizations around the country reacted immediately when they heard about the priority juvenile docket. In New York, for example, as early as August 2014, some organizations got together and decided to form an emergency coalition called the Immigrant Child Advocates Relief Effort, ICARE. There were seven organizations in that coalition: the Legal Aid Society, The Door, Catholic Charities, Central American Legal Assistance, Make the Road New York, Safe Passage, and Kids in Need of Defense. And together, they joined efforts to figure out a way to respond quickly and well to the docket. It was they who put together the questions on the intake questionnaire that my niece and I, along with other volunteers, would be using while we conducted our interviews. Ever since the priority docket was created, children are being, and will continue to be, deported in much greater numbers and at a much faster rate. Many children, though they should be given an equal right to due process, are being deported before they can even find lawyers who will take on their cases. What child can find a lawyer in 21 days? And though nonprofits reacted quickly and worked together to create a screening questionnaire that would channel children's cases as quickly as possible to legal representatives, they are understaffed and working against a ticking clock. How can a handful of organizations come up with a good plan to defend all those cases, given such little time? The priority juvenile docket, in sum, was the government's coldest, cruelest possible answer to the arrival of refugee children. Ethically, that answer was more than questionable. In legal terms, it was a kind of backdoor escape route to avoid dealing with an impending reality suddenly knocking at the country's front doors. During a short break that first morning, my niece pointed out a chalkboard pushed up against one of the walls in the screening room. On it, someone had made a list of words, divided into four categories. We reviewed it together. Border, coyote, migration police, icebox, shelter. Court, The Door and other organizations, lawyers. Home, family, guardians. Community, ? The words were written in Spanish. To me, they read like an inscrutable haiku. I don't know what my niece made of the list, but she copied everything down in a little notebook. I wasn't carrying a notebook. Later that morning, one of the lawyers explained that the list was there to help children recall the phases of their journey during the interview. She didn't say, but in some way, we understood that the words scribbled on the board were also a kind of scaffolding, holding all of those broken stories together. I recall every nuance of the first story I heard and translated in court. Perhaps only because it was the story of a boy I encountered again, a few months later, and have ever since kept in close contact with. Or perhaps because it's a story